decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial X. This is the second night and the first stream tonight. Let me tell you who I have coming on later. John Waters, New Right Post, and then Pox Populi, Angelo Plume. But first, it is a stalwart of Millennial. He's appeared every year since 2015, since it started. One of only two people one can say that about. And it is Greg Johnson, the editor of Countercurrents. Greg, welcome back to Millennial.
Thank you for having me. Merry Christmas.
Excellent. Well, I think most people are familiar with you, so there's no real need to introduce you, but describe what you do. I think everyone, Countercurrents is obviously a key part of our community. So let's just get straight into it. What would you say retrospectively about 2024?
It's been an amazing year. The people who say that nothing ever happens, they'll probably keep saying nothing ever happens, but lots of things happened this year, and a lot of things that were astonishingly good, as well as mostly a lot of bad stuff. So I thought it was a very eventful year, but a very positive year, and I'm ending the year feeling very optimistic for the next year and the year after that. I think that the sort of issues that we stand for are becoming increasingly mainstream. They're becoming increasingly able to shape mainstream politics. And I'm starting now to see signs that the establishment, the enemy establishment, is splitting. And just as when rats start leaving sinking ships, that's always a sign, right? When the rats start fleeing. It's also a sign when the rats start trying to climb aboard your ship. It really indicates that the rats, the people with no real principles, the people with no real honor, the sociopathic power elite types, the greasy pole climbers, those sorts, if they start climbing on board your ship, that is an indication that they're betting on your ship going forward and theirs going down. And I'm really seeing signs of that now. So I think it's a very good time.
Well, let's go into the events that have brought this change about. Where would you say the story starts?
Well, I think the big sea change was when Trump was reelected, because not long after Trump was reelected, and it was a surprisingly easy election. There was no obvious massive cheating. He got the popular and the electoral vote, cruised handily into office. There's virtually no serious challenge at this point to the legitimacy of the election. I started seeing things like Justin Trudeau saying that immigration's gotten a little out of hand in Canada. We need to scale this back. And then the number of 4.9 million, why not five? Why not just say 5 million? 5 million temporary visa holders in a country that doesn't even have 40 million people. The last time I visited Canada, it didn't have 30 million people in it. This is a huge percentage of the population of Canada are temporary visa holders, almost entirely non-white, of course, and they're talking about letting these visas expire. This is extraordinary. And then, of course, Keir Starmer, who's got to be one of the slimiest leftist politicians on the planet right now, is saying, yes, the great replacement has happened. It is happening. It's government policy. We need to get a handle on it. That was extraordinary, too. So I think this is a change. This is a harbinger of things to come, because I think that the left establishment is now convinced that the future lies with nationalism and populism and things like immigration control. And therefore, they're trying to get on board, basically. And I think this is good. You always want principled, intelligent, honorable people on your side. We want that. Those are the kinds of people we're trying to convert. But it's a good sign when unprincipled people are trying to get on your side as well. Because what that means is that people who are oriented not by what's good, what's true, what's honorable, but simply by what they consider to be in their interests, those sorts of people are now calculating that their interests are better served by moving in the nationalist and populist direction. If that is happening, what that I think means is that a lot of the opposition that we have been pushing against and beating our heads bloody against for decades now is going to start melting away. And we're going to find that we have momentum and that their inertial impediment to our momentum is going to start failing. And I think that when that happens, you start seeing very rapid change. So I'm hoping to see that in the new year, definitely.
Well, obviously, I'm also hoping to see that. But so I don't want to seem that I'm raining on that parade. But isn't it the case that the establishment, the system, the regime habitually offers these fig leaves or fake fig leaves and says, yeah, we've got to get immigration under control. This is a disaster. I'm sure that Barack Obama said that in the 2000s and even Bill Clinton before that, I might be wrong about that. But certainly every prime minister in Britain, every single one has said this. So Keir Starmer, on the one hand, of course, I liked to see him apparently admitting, without naming it and without naming the racial angle of it, he seemed to acknowledge the Great Replacement. Obviously, that was exciting. But in the end, it wouldn't surprise me at all if this is just to keep us, it's just a sop. It's just to keep us quiet. It's just to make us think, okay, finally, they realize their mistake. Finally, they're on our side, and really they're not going to do anything about it. I mean, what do you think is different this time?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe I'm wrong, but the tendency is for the center-right to do this kind of stuff, to give sops to people who are concerned about immigration. Margaret Thatcher did that way back in the 70s. There's no question about that. Is it a thing for the center left to get on board with this? That seems a bit new to me.
That's true.
Wasn't the Labour Party basically saying that their policy is to rub the noses of the right in immigration? These people were cheerleaders, vociferous, ferocious, mean-spirited cheerleaders for the Great Replacement for a long time. And I do think that this is a change in their messaging.
Yeah, the Labour Party said that privately, and that was revealed five years later by Andrew Nether, who'd been a speechwriter for Tony Blair. And he said that that was what was being said behind closed doors. Publicly, Labour always, with Tony Blair, claimed to be a centrist party. So not really ideological, one way or the other. Happy with capitalism, happy with people. I think Peter Mandelson said, we're happy for people to get filthy rich. We're not sort of old style lefties. So they were pretending to be a centrist party while secretly re-engineering the population. But I do agree with you that Keir Starmer, everything else he has said up until this, has been of a certain ideological ilk. And then out of the blue, he said this. And it was very surprising indeed. And I do understand, because lots of us were on Twitter, were celebrating this at the time. I think it was about 3 weeks ago now. Because it is so baffling. And of course, Justin Trudeau is even more sort of joyfully left-wing than Keir Starmer, especially on immigration. He's always sung its praises. And so for him to say, oh, well, we made a mistake, it was too much, bad calculations, etc., so we've got to change course now, it is odd. Again, a naysayer might warn that while they say these things, they might even intend to do these things, but deporting people en masse, like remigration, the reality of it might be more than these people can stomach.
Mm-hmm. Well, the passive-aggressive, nicer-than-nice, liberal, Anglosphere way of doing it is just to say, well, I'm sorry your visa's run out. Goodbye. It's been nice having you. Goodbye. And I think that could happen. That could happen, and these people will self-deport. And that's the easiest way of doing this, and this is what I've always advocated, is salami tactics, basically. But the biggest thing to do is just to get people to deport themselves by removing the incentives for them to stay. And the people who want to basically poison the idea of deportation always sell it. Oh my God, this is going to be a vast government boondoggle. Oh my God, this is going to be something like Hitler or Stalin did. And they always try and paint it in the most expensive and dystopian way possible. And then people say, no, it's unimaginable. Well, if it was possible for these people to come privately, largely on their own dime, largely on their own initiative, it's just as possible for them to leave. And we don't have to spend a whole lot of money to do that. We just have to remove the incentives for them staying and politely bid them goodbye. And then if people linger, outstay their welcome, and a certain percentage will do that, what, maybe 1 in 20? Then you send the police. So you get them to deport themselves, 95% of the time, and 5 to 3 to 2 to 1% of the time, maybe, you actually have to do the work for them. That's perfectly doable, especially when you consider the vast amount of stuff that our government manages to do to keep these people here, keep them on the dole, keep them in hotels, have all these social services. We find it completely practical for them to arrive, completely practical for them to stay, but then people paint in the blackest terms, oh, it's just inconceivable that they could leave. Oh, no, it's quite conceivable. And once they start leaving, we're going to see immediate, measurable improvements in the quality of life. When more than 10% of the populace is gone, that's going to have a measurable effect on rents and wages and the food banks will be full again, things like that. There's going to be a lot less competition, zero-sum competition in our societies. And people are going to say, wow, that was easy. Let's do some more. And it'll become addictive, right? We take one hit on the crack pipe of deportations. 5 million are gone. And we want to hit that pipe again. Why not 5? Why not 10? Why not 10 this time? In the United States, the establishment's been saying that there are 11 million illegal aliens in America, and they've been saying that, I think, since the 80s. Obviously, that number has gone way up. It's probably there are probably 11 million people who came in just during during the Biden administration. There are probably more than 50 million illegals in the United States. That is a population larger than how many countries on earth. It's a huge number of people. And if we got rid of these people slowly, peacefully, humanely, consistently with their human rights, but get rid of them nonetheless, we're going to see dramatic improvements in life in America. Wages will go up. Crime will go down, congestion will go down, crowding will go down, ugliness will go down, and also rents and housing prices will go down. It will be such a huge improvement in our economic life that libtards might even not miss the guacamole anymore, or the burritos, or they might learn to make their own burritos.
This is all, I've got a big thing about this.
I know.
Food, you know, because I realized, at some point I realized, well, but we could have had the recipes without them ever coming here. And then years later, I did some research and I found out that we actually did already have the recipes.
Yeah. Just fax over some recipes and we'll be fine. No, there's this ridiculous idea that food can only be authentic if it's touched by brown hands. Well,
and not even the right ones as well.
Yeah, well, any brown hands will do. Yeah. If you go into the back of any American restaurant, it's a Mexican restaurant.
Yes.
Today. And, you know, same by that criterion, it's all Mexican food.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same in Britain, how it's always one ethnic group doing some other ethnic group's food for.
Yeah. But somehow we need them there for authenticity. I'm sorry, that's not true. I remember years ago, I was in Atlanta and I went into a teriyaki place that had just opened up. It was sort of a fast food teriyaki place. And I don't know why I went in there. I think the person I was with wanted to go in there. We were just going to have a bite to eat, quick bite, go off to a concert or something. So anyway, the white guy at the register in the teriyaki restaurant takes my order and then says into the microphone, numero seis, grande. And I just laughed because, yeah, it's all a Mexican restaurant when you go in the back.
Yeah, it's an absurdity. Well, see, what I would certainly agree with is the left or whatever the regime have realized that there is a groundswell of opposition to mass immigration. Mm-hmm. And so something has to change, even if it's just the rhetoric.
They might just be adjusting their place in the saddle, trying to get more comfortable in control. But these people feel entitled to be in control. They want to remain in control. There were books that were being written as soon as Trump got into office, trying to understand why he got into office. And by 2018, there was a wave of books coming out that were actually really quite good. I've for years been recommending Roger Eatwell and Matthew Goodwin's book, National Populism. Another book that came out late in 2018 was White Shift by Eric Kaufman. And there were many others of that ilk. And basically, they were telling the establishment, hey, white identity politics, nationalism, populism, they're on the rise. And they're being driven by the excesses of the left. If you folks in power, they're speaking as courtiers to the people in power, if you people in power want to stay in the saddle, you've got to cool it with the identity politics, right? Or the open borders stuff, or the economic globalization stuff, because these are driving the rise of populism and the right. And it's taken a long time for that message to sink in. But to my surprise, I'm actually seeing signs that that message is sinking in. And it really took the second Trump victory for some of these people to say, okay, the writing is on the wall. We really have to readjust course. We can do all kinds of other goofy liberal stuff, but the Great Replacement is so dangerous, it's going to perhaps destroy all of our other plans for society, right? I don't know what their plans are. I dread their plans. I shudder to think what their other goofy plans are. I'm sure it has to do with hormone blockers and things like that. But maybe they think that they've got to ease up on the diversity stuff and the open border stuff if they want to hold on to the really essential stuff, whatever they think that is.
Well, you see, I would say that the transgender stuff is, if any aspect of wokery is peaking, I would say it's that.
I would say that's correct, too. There was evidence from this recent election, I forget the source now, saying that the trans stuff, it absolutely played the worst amongst centrist voters and non-white voters who would normally vote for the Democrats, even. That this stuff is poison. And it's so obviously insane, and it's so obvious that basically the Democratic Party was taken over by some kind of cult. I remember when Biden was running back in 2020, and he was saying ritualistically, it was almost like he was a hostage. You know, the hostage is reading off the cards in the video that's being sent. But he said, you know, we must stand against the murderers of black trans women or something like that. It's like, this is a totally made up problem. And if you actually look at how many black trans women are killed and by whom, they're usually prostitutes who are killed by enraged cis hetero black men. it's an entirely black on black problem. But the idea that America is going to be judged by how well it deals with the epidemic of crime against black trans women. This was actually one of the crazy talking points that they were basically repeating mantra-like back in 2020. It's totally laughable. And they're not trying that today. They weren't trying that in this election. I think it was already being dialed back a little bit. Of course, they couldn't keep Rachel Levine completely, you know, in a burqa or anything like that. But yeah, I don't even recall them being too pandery to the trans agenda.
Mm. Yeah, I think it does seem that they've realized it plays terribly. Although that is yet to permeate into British TV, unfortunately, but because I'm not going to get into talking about this, but it still does seem to be a fashionable thing over here, and maybe in American TV as well. But in politics, they seem to have realized this doesn't play well. I can't believe it took them so long. I think they really wanted it. I think they really wanted to just push it, no matter what. And only gave up on it in the 11th hour sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, with regard to immigration, here's one way that I could see it going in America. This is going by what Elon Musk has said and what Trump has said. I'm sure that others are relevant as well have said similar things, which is that they don't want mass immigration anymore. Or at least they don't want mass immigration of just anyone. They want high IQ, capable, I don't know what terms they would use, but economically beneficial immigrants coming in. So that's the Indian tech workers and the Indian CEOs, but not the criminal underclass mass. Because after all, why on earth would any sane person want those people coming into their country? It's just blatantly insane to want Hispanic gang members or black thugs or whatever coming into your country. Why on earth would you want that? It's on the face of it, it's crazy. But they've done that under the auspices of just diversity. It's just diversity.
That's about the only thing you can say for these people is they're not like us.
Yeah, yeah. But unfortunately, that's the more they're not like us, the more they shouldn't be here, really.
Yeah.
Diversity is not a strength. But you and I know that. But the point is that this is the way I could see it going in America, given the rhetoric. So it's like you could say a return to the 80s in some ways, that mentality where race doesn't matter, it just winning matters, merit, capability. What would you say about that? Because obviously that has its own dangers. of people being replaced and disenfranchised, dispossessed at a higher level in society.
Well, it is a problem, but let's be honest here. The choice that we faced was between high levels of legal immigration, which we already have, plus out-of-control illegal immigration. That was what Kamala Harris was offering. And closing the borders, deporting criminals, deporting millions of these people, and having legal immigration that's more selective. That's a no-brainer. It's hugely an improvement what Trump is talking about, what Elon Musk is talking about. Is it ideal? No. In fact, it's terrible. One of the things that I would like to do, and we're doing work on this in the new year, is we need to question the premise that if people are coming here because of job skills, that should be equivalent to immigration. What's the alternative? The alternative is having a guest worker program or some kind of limited visas where people come on a visa to work in a particular industry, maybe for a particular period of time. It's not a pathway to citizenship. It's not an invitation to join our country. They're there for a particular reason, an economic reason that has to be proven. It can't just be that your boss prefers to pay you less, so he's going to compete, you know, bring in competing labor from other parts of the world. There has to be some compelling reason why this person would be there. But why does that mean immigration? Right? Elon Musk was tweeting about this today. We want a system that allows immigration of hardworking, qualified people. Well, why immigration? Why not just if we really need hardworking, qualified people in particular areas of our economy, for reasons, again, other than simply undercutting wages, then why not bring them in for a 2-year contract and send them back? That's how the debate needs to be reframed, because our oligarchs are going to keep demanding workers, right? And it's like a nicotine patch. The oligarchy is addicted to cheap labor. We have to wean them from their addiction to cheap labor. How do we do that? Well, we give them the nicotine patch of guest workers, because that gives them their cheap labor, but it doesn't put these people on a path to citizenship. Now, of course, the danger is that the guest worker thing would be changed down the road into a path to citizenship. But I think it would be valuable, though, to get people raising this question. Okay, sure, let's just grant for the sake of argument that your company needs some people to do jobs that aren't available in the United States. How long would it take to train Americans to do that job? 2 years? Oh, okay. Well, let's start training Americans to do that job, and as a stopgap for the next 2 years, you can hire somebody on a temporary work visa from overseas to fill that spot in your corporation. If we started doing that, first of all, everybody would know these people's names. They'd be here under visas. They'd have to present compelling cases for why they're coming. And it wouldn't be an argument about immigration anymore. It wouldn't be an argument about the future and of the nation and its identity anymore. It would simply be basically, okay, the left and their arguments for immigration. Oh, we need more diversity. It'll make us stronger and richer to flood our countries with beggars. And if you don't like it, you deserve it for your sins anyway. Those arguments are dying. Those are idiotic arguments, and those are dying. The strongest argument that people are now hearing is it's good for the economy. And if we can basically say, well, wait a second here, if we're just talking about what's good for the economy, that doesn't necessarily give you an argument for immigration per se, merely for guest workers on a temporary visa with no possibility of a road to citizenship. If they marry, the family reunification takes place in their home country. They can't have anchor babies. They can't marry their way in. Nothing. None of that. If we start having that debate, I think that that would be a valuable shift. Because, yeah, it is very, very harmful to have the immigration advocates immediately pivot to the, we want good qualified immigrants. Why not just say we want good qualified workers for temporary work visas, and that's that. That takes their argument away. It's no longer an argument for immigration at that point. It's simply an argument for making it possible for people to come and work in America.
Yeah, it would be a pragmatic thing rather than a great big moral cultural crusade.
Yeah.
The country.
Yeah, and we have a moral cultural crusade to wreck our countries that the left is championing. And the right goes along with it because most of them are bought and paid for shills, but they make it plausible to their constituency by talking about immigration for economic needs. High quality people. Don't you deserve the best after all? America deserves the best. So why don't we take the best people from Pakistan and Cameroon? Right? Surely there's some best people in Pakistan and Cameroon. Of course, that raises the question, why should we be strip mining poor countries of their best people? If you want to make a moral crusade against that, you could gin up a very quick, good argument against that. It would actually be very left-coded, interestingly enough.
Yeah, indeed. And I've made that point in the past, that this is actually sick, what we're doing. We're denuding these countries of the people they need most, and they need them more than we do. You know, we might need them for an economic reason, but they're desperate for them.
So absolutely. I remember when the riots were going on in the UK, and there were people on British Twitter, British X, tweeting about, I just had my hip replaced at the NHS by a doctor from Afghanistan. You know, take that, you racist chuds. And what I did is I just found the number of doctors per 1,000 people in Afghanistan and the number of doctors per 1,000 people in the UK and just put that out. Unfortunately, Elon Musk's platform took down that account. It's lost in time now. But anyway, it was a good point. They're like 0.5 doctors per 1,000 in Afghanistan and like, I don't know, 22 per 1,000 in the UK. And yet somehow this person thought it was just a killer knockdown virtue signal to talk about how he received medical service from a doctor from Afghanistan. He's just a vicious prick, basically, benefiting from the brain drain of his country. But he's pretending to be virtuous. It reminds me of what Renaud Camus said in his book, The Great Replacement, about the marriage of convenience between capital and the left. Once capital decided to wed itself to these left-wing talking points, it became morally unimpeachable, right? They really want cheap labor, so they bring in diversity, right? And it is very interesting how incredibly selfish and exploitative behavior that 50 or 100 years ago would be denounced as colonialism, right? That this has now been laundered into virtue by linking it to left-wing talking points.
Well, the other thing is that the reason we need so many doctors and consultants and surgeons from these countries is the we have huge numbers of patients in British hospitals. Huge numbers of the patients are from these countries. So they're expanding the need for surgery and medical care and so forth. By coincidence, I was actually in a London hospital just a few days ago because a friend of mine had an accident. And it's very visible that the patients, I mean, a lot of the staff are foreign for sure, but the majority of the patients are foreign. There's no question about it. So if it weren't for their presence here already, we wouldn't need so many doctors and nurses and so forth. Yeah, it's a problem that creates itself. So I don't know if there's any more that you'd want to say about, I mean, are you feeling overall, it sounds like you are feeling overall optimistic about Trump's second presidency?
Well, I am a bit more optimistic about Trump's second presidency than I was about his first presidency, which sank very, very quickly. Trump has better people around him. He seems less naive. And therefore, I think he's going to have marginally less crazed opposition this time around. We'll see about that. But things are going great right now. Of course, he hasn't even been sworn in yet. It is kind of interesting. It's a fascinating phenomenon. He's running the country now. Foreign leaders are coming to visit him. They're basically just ignoring Biden. And why shouldn't they? I mean, he's not really there anyway. They're ignoring Biden. They're ignoring his administration. They're going to Mar-a-Lago for audiences with Trump. He's acting like Augustus after the Civil Wars were over, when he was just presiding over the country, over the empire, as the first citizen, but everybody went to him, and he had all this power because everybody thought he had this power. And he doesn't even have official control of the machinery of state, and still he has this power. It's interesting. It's almost an argument for dictatorship, and we're going to get a really cold shower, unfortunately, when they actually inaugurate him, swear him in, and then he's got to work with these idiots in the Congress. At that point, all these good feelings are going to come to a screeching halt, and we're going to go back to American governmental gridlock for the most part, and it's going to be an interesting struggle. But my feeling is that he'll move the needle in positive ways on immigration and on globalization, and he's going to give us some time to fix things. Because Trump doesn't want to fix things the way I want to fix things. He would be scandalized at the idea that we just need to return America to a white homeland. He'd be scandalized by that. But if some of the policies that he wants to do that help us get closer to America as a white homeland actually go through, that's going to make our work easier rather than harder. So I'm looking forward to the new year. I'm looking forward to I'm looking forward to the fights. I think they're going to be interesting fights. They're going to be battles royale, right, in the press, on social media, about things like deportation. And these are intellectual battles that we can win.
Yes.
And I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Do you think that the left is quite demoralized at this point?
I think the left, when compared to the right in terms of its moral strength, is enormously more strong than the right. Even now, they're enormously stronger. But yes, they are relatively demoralized from where they were over the last, you know, almost 10 years since Trump emerged as a candidate. They were at such a high pitch of emotional intensity for almost a decade that I think some of them are really burned out. But that should not by any means be an argument for complacency, because they're so much stronger than the right. And by the right, I mean the center right. The vast majority of rightists are just soft, complacent, goofy people who just want to get along and just want to be left alone and will easily just gratefully, like starved dogs, just grab onto any bone that's thrown to them. And we simply can't win with people like that. We have to be much stronger as a cultural and political force to win. And that's why we need a new right. The new right has to be enormously militant and enormously principled. We have to be filled with passionate intensity. I'm always quoting Yeats from The Second Coming, the couplet, the worst are filled, the best lack all conviction. That's the center right. The worst are filled with passionate intensity. That's the left. The only way to beat these people is to up our intensity, our emotional intensity, and our militancy. Otherwise, we simply lose against them. That differential of emotional intensity means that other things being equal, they carry the day. And this is why they have been able to relentlessly drag America into the abyss for more than 150 years, really, since the end of the Civil War. We saw the emergence of an American left. I was talking about this today in a fundraiser I put up about The Nation magazine, which was founded in 1865, after the Civil War. Once abolitionism had triumphed in the Civil War, the left moved on to other things. And The Nation magazine was founded almost 160 years ago. It's the longest running weekly magazine in America. And they have been at the vanguard of pulling America ever further to the left for nearly 160 years. And they do that because they have a vision and they have moral intensity, moral conviction, passionate and emotional intensity. And the people who have these ideals also put up the money to make sure that these people stay at it. The Nation has made a profit only 1 year in 159 years of publication. And yet they have been sustained by people who understand the value of ideas. So we have to recognize that, yes, the left is a bit demoralized, and this is a bit of an opportunity, but it is not an opportunity to go back to being goofy, center-rightists, goofy, selfish, complacent center-rightists. It's an opportunity for us to build up our strength because we're going to have an enormous battle ahead. And it's going to be a battle that will take generations to finally fix the mess that this world is in.
Yeah, I think a huge problem is the psychological differences between the left and the right, as well, especially the left and the center right. That's the real problem, because the center right, it's almost like they feel politics is about pragmatics and the economy and so forth, and it's uncouth and bad manners to actually care about something and to actually have designs for your country and your society. That's childish even and idealistic. But it's almost like they feel that's, it's other people's privilege to be like that. We have to be dull as hell, because that is, or that's just that, or they simply are dull.
A lot of them are dull. Isn't it interesting, though, that for all the edginess of the Zoomer right, one thing they have in common with boomer republicanism is their lack of seriousness, their lack of moral seriousness. It's all a joke. It's all ironic. It's all a game. Now, Boomer Republicans aren't, you know, tittering and laughing and edgy, making edgy humor. That's not their style. But the underlying moral substance is the same. They don't take it seriously. It's a game. It's a form of self-indulgence. That, I think, is disturbing. Because, again, we're in a struggle for the future of civilization. And you don't win by being ironic and frivolous. There are no ironists in foxholes, right? And we have to take this battle very, very seriously. And so irony is useful as cover, as bluff, as, you know, a garnish, as trimmings, whatever, as a way of getting people to dip their toe in, try things on for size, whatever. But if you don't close the deal from irony to absolute commitment and militancy, then it's not going to go anywhere. And you're just wasting time.
Yeah, I think that's been seen, that people who treat this as a game and a bit of fun and ironic, and who aren't really serious, who aren't really trying to protect something, it doesn't last all that long. I mean, their game becomes quite tedious and obvious. I mean, you see a lot of these grifters on social media, and they tend to have a certain lifespan, because ultimately it becomes clear that they're just not serious. They're just not serious people.
Yeah, and the other thing that I think that the newish, edgy right has in common with the boomer republicanism that they disdain and despise is the essentially egoistic way that they think. Because so many people in this movement, especially the e-celeb types, are egomaniacs. They are in it for ego gratification. It's all the virtue of selfishness for them, just like it is for these boomer Republican types who are all about rational self-interest and so forth. And again, you don't win a struggle if one side is all about comfort and security and rational self-interest understood in a very bourgeois way, and the other side is literally willing to kill and die for their ideals. That's just another way of rephrasing the differential in emotional intensity between the left and the right. The right won't die for their ideas. Their highest value is a long and comfortable life. And people like that are natural slaves. And people who are willing to put their lives on the line for matters of principle are not natural slaves. I mean, these are people who will not live under just any condition. And we simply cannot be these bourgeois conservative types who say every man's got his price and this is my price and give me what I want and I'll sell out, you know, because in the end it's all about them and it's all about ego gratification. We have so many e-celeb types with their little cults of personality. You can tell they're just so hungry. They're hungry for money and they're hungry for recognition. Cults of personality don't happen spontaneously. They don't happen by accident. They happen because they're cultivated, and they're cultivated by needy people, emotionally needy people who want to be surrounded by yes men and adoring worshipers. And if you aren't that kind of person, you're not going to have that cult of personality around you. And so many of these people with their cults of personality are fundamentally bourgeois in the sense that they're simply selfish people. They're selfish, egocentric, egomaniacal people, but those are not the hardest people in the world. And we need to be much harder if we're going to win.
Yeah. Would you say that this current generation of e-celebs, that kind of thing in America, has a predecessor in the sort of talk radio right-wing shock jock type from like 20, 30 years ago?
Could you repeat that? I mean, I think one word dropped out.
Sorry. America has this history of right-wing shock jock talking heads on talk radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are they a natural predecessor to the e-celebs of today?
Yes. Yes, they are. I think that there's a continuity there, definitely. I don't hate these talk radio types, people like that. Some of them are actually entertaining people. They're entertaining, but again, and they can be used to get messages out, right? But these are not the characters of political leaders. I guess that's the thing I just want to say. If we're going to take this from being a movement that propagandizes and entertains to a movement that actually wins in politics, we're going to have a different breed of people leading it. Just because you have a popular podcast doesn't make you a leader. And that's I think, the thing that has to be understood. And there's something of the essentially self-indulgent, selfish, bourgeois individualist that you find even in our sort of right that makes them as ultimately ineffectual politically as the Republicans or the Tories. And they're just not good enough. We've seen that these people aren't good enough. But most of us aren't good enough either, because we don't have the right ethos yet to win.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a mistake people often make that if someone is good at presenting a show, for example, then they would also be good in politics, in the world of politics. And something I realized early on is that I certainly wouldn't be good in the world of politics. I'd be eaten alive. I'm far too nice. But there are all sorts of other reasons why someone just might not be good in that world. It is a specific set of character traits and skills that you have to have. And I think this is what we're starting to see now with this Trump 2, is that the people you need to lead this kind of thing are organized. They get up at the right time in the morning. They wear a suit. They're sorted out. They've got their emotions under control. They're respectable looking, you know, this kind of thing. And they have skills in organizing and negotiating, this sort of thing. It's not traits that one associates with our community very much, at least not the prominent people in it, because we tend to be very headstrong and obstinate and even argumentative and so forth. Now, that's good for debate, but it's not good for actually building something in the real world. And so the types that you need to do that are the types who, up till now, have been part of the mainstream. They've been the ones organizing, you know, Keir Starmer's events or Tony Blair's events, and so forth. What we need to see is them now doing our work for us, the stuff that we've wanted to see. And I think that is starting to happen with Trump too. Things that would have seemed impossible for us will just happen because it's the right people doing it. The right people are in the right positions.
I think that that's true. I hope that that's true. We are sort of revolutionary bohemian types. Definitely. The kinds of people who make institutions work have different psychological profiles, different styles. Yeah. And I've learned this over the years by creating institutions. I've created several of them, And I realize how hard it is and what a stretch it is and how I need to find people who are psychologically different than me and have different skill sets to make these things work. So, yeah, I am very hopeful for what's coming. Again, it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be Trump who hands us what we want, but I think he can make it easier for us. And the fact that he won again, I think, makes it more conceivable that our sort of politics will be winning in Europe as well. Back in 2022, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, that's a hope that things seep over from America, from a right-wing Trump America, that especially on the matter of freedom of speech, for example. I mean, I know he's very much up. He's very into that. He wants to stop social media companies from banning and shadow banning and de-boosting and all that. That will only affect Americans, though. So what I'm hoping is that mentality seeps over into Europe, and it just becomes sort of untenable to do to European citizens, German citizens, British citizens, what you couldn't do to American, what you would be legally banned from doing to American citizens.
Yeah,
that would be great.
Well, the United States State Department has been pushing censorship on Europe under the Biden administration. And it's been going on much longer than that. I remember back, in the early 2000s, when there was talk of bringing countries in Eastern and Central Europe into NATO, that ideas were being floated. Basically, if Romania wanted to adapt the United States Constitution or the U.S. Bill of Rights, the U.S. State Department would have said, oh, no, you can't join NATO with the U.S. Bill of Rights. You need hate crimes laws on the books. Obviously, the people who are pushing this were up to no good. But yeah, the United States has been pushing censorship laws on Europe for at least two decades. And that's very disturbing, more than two decades. So maybe if that machine is simply switched off, that would be a big help to Europe as well. But yes, I do think that companies like X, by defying European censorship, would be a good thing too. So I think that there's going to be in 2016, when Brexit happened, people I knew in Europe were saying, if this can happen, Trump can get elected. These were normies. Normies were saying this. If Brexit can happen, Trump can get elected. If Trump can get elected, Marine Le Pen can get elected, right? And it's true. It's a psychologically true statement that if people see that something is possible, then it becomes more likely. Right. This is why they go around saying white extinction is inevitable. Immigration is inevitable. It's impossible to change it. No, it's not impossible. And as soon as people believe it's possible to change these things, they will change it. If Brexit can happen, Trump can get elected. It eased the way to Trump getting elected. If Trump gets elected and Trump gets elected again, that's going to ease the way for more radical right populist types to get into power in Europe and to keep it. It just seems more conceivable. And of course, it goes both ways. Brexit made Trump more conceivable. But there is this definite phenomenon that we can't underestimate, that the things that happen in America really matter to Europe. All too much, right? America is overly influential on Europe. I wish it weren't true. But when America is going in a good direction, at least, that's good for our people in Europe. So I'm hoping that just as the American left seems a little bit demoralized right now, that the European left, by contagion, is feeling a little bit demoralized too. And that's going to mean that the European right has a slight advantage in the coming years, and I hope that they make the most of it.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with what you're saying about the psychology of things seeming possible and making things seem possible. I don't know to what extent Brexit was responsible for Trump's win. I'm sure it had some psychological effect on the right in America, mm-hmm. but I do think that it's not just Trump in 2016. 2016 has two things in it, and the other one is Brexit. Like historically,
yeah,
it was a dual thing, and it really did have a huge Brexit had a huge effect on the left. I think worldwide, not just in Britain. Mm-hmm. As for things seeming possible, this is why I really like the catchphrase slogan that is said on Twitter an awful lot, which is remigration is inevitable.
It is inevitable.
I really like that because it sort of gets you into the right frame of mind. It's not we would like remigration or wouldn't it be nice if remigration happened? It's not just a demand even. It's not even a demand. It's a statement of reality. It's redefining reality. Now, obviously, there are limits to that. You could say, well, it's actually just delusion. But then there is the thing about fake it till you make it. You have to be in a certain frame of mind in order to do anything. If I don't think that I can stand up and go over and get a glass of water, then I'm, and it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
So I think this is very important for morale. And that in turn is important for actual success.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and the other thing is that remigration, and I've said this before, I'll say it no doubt many more times on this millennial, it was unthinkable 2 years ago that remigration would be a mainstream talking point.
Yeah.
It's completely unthinkable. There was Martin Selner was really pushing it, and he was very confident about it. He was very forthright he did a lot of work in pushing this idea. But not many other people, and forgive me if there's anyone who was really instrumental in that and that I'm not naming them now, but I apologize. But the point is that it has really taken off in the last year, mm-hmm. and even just the last 6 months. And so it shows that something like this can literally be forced into the discourse, into the mainstream. You know, there are people in our community who are very skeptical about the idea of the Overton window, that anything we do really has much effect. I'm certain that you would be you would disagree with that. You think what we say and the discourse and it does matter, and it is possible to push to shift the Overton window.
Absolutely, and we've been doing that. I have been doing Countercurrent since 2010. I remember in 2011, Renaud Camus coined the term the Great Replacement. I believe it was in 2011. It's certainly when I first heard about it. That was also the year that the white genocide meme was coined. I was one of the first people to talk to, I think I was the first person to interview Tim Murdoch of White Rabbit Radio, who was pushing the white genocide meme. He told me that. And I saw through French social media sources this great replacement idea moving around. In 2011, it was marginal within white nationalism. Now these are mainstream talking points. The great replacement was talked about by Tucker Carlson a couple of years ago now. It is a mainstream center-right topic of discussion now. White genocide, not so much, but it's basically the same idea. They go hand in hand. If you want to talk about one, the other can come up. So this is important progress that we've made. I remember, I think it was in 2009, I wanted to do work when I was editing the Occidental Quarterly. I wanted to promote discussion of secession as an idea. If it's possible for whiter areas to secede from the United States or other countries as a way of basically gathering white peoples together and putting barriers around them, creating homelands. And I remember there's a lot of resistance to that. People rolled their eyes at it. The very idea that you would be talking about secession. And now secession for explicitly or implicitly racial reasons is another normie Republican talking point. They talk about national divorce, but they're really talking about secession. Also, the idea that we use divorce as a metaphor, as an analogy for explaining secession and separating peoples, that's something that I heard first in our circles. I heard it from Sam Dixon. I heard it from Jared Taylor. I wrote a piece, I think, as far back as 2015 called Irreconcilable Differences, The Case for National Divorce.
Right.
And that is a very compelling argument. I didn't think of it first. I think the first person that used that, it was in conversation with me, it was Sam Dixon. I know Jared has used this in his speeches. You know, great minds think alike. And in my case, I just got it from Sam. But it's a very powerful talking point, and it is now become mainstream. I remember sometime, I think it was 2003, Mike Polignano had his own website, and there were two memes on there that I think have had a huge influence since then. They were, as far as I know, the first occurrences in our sphere of these memes. One was Taking Our Own Side. He has an article called Taking Our Own Side. It's up at Countercurrents. It's in his book. And basically the argument at the end of this piece is that, you know, Robert Frost said a liberal is the kind of person who wouldn't take his own side in a fight. And white nationalists realize that we are in a world in locked in racial and ethnic struggles. And what white nationalism is taking our own side in these ethnic struggles. That has been used very widely now. And I think it came from Mike. The other thing that's even more consequential is he wrote a piece about visiting William Pierce. I think it was in 2000 or 1999, he visited William Pierce. And he had an allergy attack because of Pierce's cats. And Pierce went in the other room and came back with a pill in his hand. And it was some red pill. And he thought of himself, he thought of the Matrix. And he thought, okay, you know, I've got to trust this guy. You know, here's this guy offering me this red pill. Do I really trust him and take the red pill? And he went on and said, yeah, I took the red pill and my allergy symptoms cleared up. But he...
Well, I'd sooner trust William Pierce than Morpheus.
Yeah, exactly. But still, I mean, here's this guy who's living on a compound in West Virginia, this fearsome... guy with his fearsome reputation, and he has hands you a pill. It's like, do you take the pill? But he was the first person that I know that likened our process of conversion to taking the red pill in the Matrix. And I that's a huge meme now. It's absolutely central. And as far as I know, he was the first person in our circles who did that. Now, maybe other people did too.
That's amazing. I've never known this until now.
Yeah, but the point is that these ideas have gone from the margins to the mainstream. And yes, remigration is something we've been talking about for years. I've been saying, you know, for 20 years now, if it was possible for them to come, it's possible for them to leave. They have to go back. Planes, trains, and automobiles. And, you know, it's something that in white nationalist circles has been a constant talking point. And people like Martin Selner have been very, very good at promoting this in Europe. And yeah, it's now breaking through as well. So we are changing the discourse. Our memes and our ideas and our talking points and our moral outlook are shifting the parameters of debate. And so I'm very, very optimistic. I'm very optimistic in this sense. The left is morally and intellectually bankrupt. They have no good ideas anymore. They just have hysterical dogmas that they have to enforce at gunpoint, basically. And just sort of weird cultish enthusiasms like transmania, right? The right is enormously better in terms of its ideas. We have the right ideas. We can make society work. They have terrible ideas. They cause death and suffering and destruction wherever they go. Why haven't we won yet? Well, part of it is they've just been at it longer than us. We are reacting to them. They came first, and we're trying to fix their problems. So that is a thing. They do have a head start on us. They do have institutions and inertia on their side. There's no question about it. The other thing that they have that we lack is moral strength. Again, we have to go back to this. I wrote a piece on Richard Hanania, who's a despicable person, a disgusting, despicable person, who used to write for Countercurrents way back when. And he stopped writing for us, and he was going to go off to grad school, and he did. He went off to grad school and reinvented himself and became this public intellectual. And then he got doxxed as a hateful racist, you know, a sexist racist, an anti-Semite. I mean, the stuff that he was writing for Countercurrents, he wrote an article that praised Kevin MacDonald's Culture of Critique. This is all out there in the public record. And this guy knew the dox was coming long before it became apparent to the world and reinvented himself as this contrarian, sleazy, Shabbos goy type. And the comment I made about this was that Richard Hanania is just encapsulates everything that's wrong with the right. He knew the truth. He was writing about it, and he didn't change his mind. But he's lying. Why? Because he's weak. Because he's cowardly. Because he's greedy. He had a good thing going, and he wanted to hold on to it. And he has basically twisted himself into knots, lying in order to try and hold on to what he had. And this is what this is why the left wins. The left is intellectually bankrupt, but the right, even though we have the truth on our side, is full of cowards and grifters like Hanania. And until we overcome that problem, we're not going to beat them, but we're still making progress.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I'm very interested in this idea that the left is morally and intellectually bankrupt, because when I was growing up, you know, when I was coming of age in the 90s, throughout the course of the 90s, the left was, it's strange to say it now, because I now know that the left had been going for decades and had been culturally dominant for decades, but even by then. But in the 90s, the left felt seemed ascendant, and new, and still battering against a crusty conservative establishment. That was its own self-image. That was how the left sold itself, and I bought that because I was too young and naive to know any better. But the point is that it was a convincing story. It seemed real. There were still enough old conservatives around in Britain. You would see them on TV, like aristocrats. You'd see them on TV, hear them on the radio. That you could believe this, that the hip university professor, the hip intellectual, was breaking down barriers, was breaking the establishment apart, mm-hmm. and so forth. And so the point is that the ideas seemed fresh and strong. And then throughout the 2000s, and certainly by 2015, all of that had changed. And at this point, 10 years on from then, the left seems not just moribund, but dead and, well, insane, like holding mm-hmm. on to, proclaiming things that are insane. Like, they're probably the epitome of, well, unless a drag queen story hour, that would obviously be a particular example of this. But perhaps the epitome of it is the idea that the man who has got hormone therapy and now has breasts can breastfeed a child. Because and we have to believe that, because if we don't believe that, then that weakens the whole trans thing. So it has to be that his breasts are producing milk. That fluid has to, we have to believe that it's milk. Because if we don't, then we're betraying the whole cause. Mm-hmm. We're admitting that the whole thing is a farce. So you end up believing crazy, crazy stuff like that and mm-hmm. going along with it. And then another example, a similar sort of thing, would be when the child of two trannies, let's say, ends up being a tranny himself.
I guess it's just hereditary.
Yeah, well, it's all just coincidence.
Coincidence, yeah.
I mean, and it's like, what are the odds of that? I mean, common sense tells you, your common sense is screaming at you, there is no way that this happened by coincidence. And, well, unless...
That child needs to be taken away from his parents. Exactly. Somebody said it very nicely, I forget who it was. If you're, you know, 20 years old and think you are a member of another, the opposite sex, you've got a mental illness. If you're 8 years old and think that you are a member of the opposite sex, your mother has a mental illness. There's no question about it. There is this phenomenon of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, where mothers gain attention by inflicting illness on their children. And the whole trans kids thing is just another form of Munchausen by proxy. And I think that's a hypothesis. Let me put that out there as a hypothesis. That's a hypothesis that could be tested. And
it's, I think, plausible. It has been tested.
Yeah.
I'm fairly sure there was. I'm sure I saw a survey about a year ago. Yeah. Rings a bell. Some survey that showed that the mothers, specifically the mothers of trans children, have a very high proneness to mental illness.
Yeah, and Munchausen is a mental illness that only is found with women, interestingly enough. Although I do have a hypothesis that Anthony Fauci made the world sick in a kind of grand global Munchausen's by proxy, because he's been rehearsing global pandemics for decades now. And if the globe has a pandemic, suddenly he's at the center of global attention. It's the same structure as Munchausen's by proxy, where mentally ill women gain basically recognition as caregivers and sufferers, right? If they have a sick child. And I think that Fauci, gained global recognition as a visionary and a authority because the world was convinced that it was in the grip of a terrible pandemic, an unusually terrible pandemic. So there is a possibility there. But generally, it's a disease that you find among women. It's a woman's problem. But of course, these people believe that anybody could be a man or a woman, right? They don't believe in sex differences. But mm-hmm. yeah, There's a Munchausen's by proxy is a female thing, and almost every child that's being transed is being transed because he has a mentally ill mother. It's so sad.
It's terrible. But without dwelling on that specifically, that those were just two examples that I gave of the breastfeeding and the and in which case it's a man who's been transing into a will, you know. So it's not the mother, although she'll be having to go along with it. Or in the case of the two transgender parents who just happen to have a transgender child. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the celebrities, even like Charlize Theron, who it just happens to be that her kids.
Both of them. What are the chances? Yeah. What are the chances? Yes.
It's remarkable. But the point I was making was that the left is at this point where, in order to sustain their worldview, they have to believe things that are obviously false and crazy, like crackpot. And so in that sense, I think, yes, they're bankrupt. But I don't think that they would see it that way. I think they would think, no, we're on top of the world. We're still doing really well. We've still, you know, got so much better ideas than the right. The right just wants to turn the clock back. It's not in touch with reality, and it's bigoted. Whereas we are.
Yeah, they just have cliches, though. They have cliches and a bloated sense of entitlement, a bloated sense of false superiority, but they can't defend this craziness. They simply can't. And that's the sense in which they're intellectually bankrupt. The fact that they are so convinced that their survival depends on censorship. That's not the attitude of people who are confident of their intellectual abilities and the truth of their positions.
And well, then that gets us to the topic of blue sky. Mm-hmm. And I know that since you're not on X, Twitter, this might not
maybe be- I should get on blue sky. I might be more welcome there.
Maybe you would, but it might not be forefront of your mind in the way that it is for those of us on X. I see Libs of, I think it's Libs of TikTok or something, has created a new account, Libs of Blue Sky. Where they post screenshots of, and oddly enough, I actually went on Blue Sky and had a look, and I made a couple of screenshots myself like 3 months ago, just out of curiosity. But then I shared one of them. But it was, I mean, you really see that, okay, this is what they say kind of behind closed doors, as it were. This is what they say when they're not worried about being harassed by right-wingers. They just come out with childish nonsense. Nonsense. Drivelling, idealistic, naive, it has to be deliberate. It's almost like, okay, we're in our hug box now, so we can delude ourselves now. Let's delude ourselves. Quick. And they just share these silly ideas. Mm-hmm. And so I spied in on that just briefly. And I had more important things to do. So I left it. But so there's this account sharing this stuff. And it is interesting. There's this, I read this once a couple of years ago, that the more censorship you have, the more left-wing the space will be. Mm-hmm. And the less censorship you have, the more right-wing the space will be. But I know how that would be perceived, but the left would say, yes, that's because crazy right-wingers are allowed to browbeat us and demoralize us.
Whereas
would say, yeah, it's because our ideas win out.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but right-wingers are not the most psychologically intense, demoralizing, browbeating people around. That would be libtards. That would be leftists. Again, they so much of what they accuse us of is just projection when you get right down to it.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, that's true. There's a huge amount of that. I mean, I even think that political correctness is actually, they're projecting their bigotry. Like they don't like black people. They find foreigners gross and, you know, unpleasant and so on. And so they project that onto us. I also think that there's a certain eugenic tendency on the left that they think if someone isn't perfect, like if equality isn't possible, then there has to be genocide. I think there are some, at least some left wingers who in deep down, this is actually what they think, because they're so unhappy with the concept of people not being equal that their only reaction to it is they either deny it and insist that people are all equal, or they eliminate it by eliminating the inferior. I can see that sort of hysterical, because the right's response is to inequality is to accept it. You know, we can deal with it. It's all right. It's not the end of the world. But I think among leftists, there's a sort of absolutist reaction to this. So they have to believe in equality, because if they don't, then they have to believe in genocide and eugenics and so on. I don't know. It's just a pet theory of mine, but there it is. But at any rate, I think they do project their own shrillness and small-mindedness, if you like, onto the right. Because the right, most right-wingers are not that extreme or irrational or crazed or whatever, anything but.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Countercurrents did a poll of our readers, and we have a mailing list of about 5,500 readers, and we got about one out of 10, 550 or so, to fill out an extensive poll. I think it has 115 questions in it. And it, you know, it took a while, but it was a great poll for us, because we wanted to understand the people who already read us. Because if there are patterns that we can notice about who we are, that will help us make better outreach, right? So if there are certain traits that we have that we didn't think that we had or very common, that changes the way we think about ourselves, and it changes how we communicate with the world. We want to find more people like us, and we also want to reach out to broader categories of humanity as well. So it was a very, very useful project. One of the things that we discovered was when we asked people to fill out the Big Five or the Ocean personality inventory, is that the typical countercurrents reader was off the charts high on openness, extreme openness. And then in terms of conscientiousness and extroversion, we tended to be higher than average. And in terms of, so it's conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness. Right. Yeah. We tend to be middling in terms of agreeableness. Extremely high openness, high conscientiousness, middling in extroversion and agreeableness. And then the wild card was the neuroticism one. And some of our people are rather neurotic, and others are very, very unneurotic. So my profile was extremely high openness, extremely high conscientiousness, middling levels of extroversion and agreeableness, and extremely low neuroticism. A lot of the people that I work best with had the exact same profile. Again, the only big variant was the level of neuroticism, because let's face it, a lot of people have a lot of reasons to be unhappy, right?
Yeah.
A lot of our people are definitely unhappy with the world around us. And some of us deal with it better than others. Okay. But isn't that interesting? Another thing that we discovered is that I think like 40% of our readers are INTJs in terms of the Myers-Briggs thing, which I think about 2% of the population is, which is, you know, it's very overrepresented. ENTJs, I think we were like 10% ENTJs, and I think that's like, again, maybe 2% of the overall population. So there are certain Myers-Briggs types that are massively overrepresented in our circles. But the idea that one of the ocean test dimension that we were most excessive on, perhaps, was openness. I thought that was fascinating. Now, leftists love to pose as we are open-minded, right? But I wonder how open leftists really are if you sat them down and made them take that test. I don't think they're very open. I do think they like to think of themselves as that way, but I don't think that they actually are that way.
See, I can see it being true that they were open-minded in the 90s. I can see the type of person who was a leftist in the 90s, or a just liberal in the 90s, yes, but not the kind of person who was a leftist in the 2010s. By then, it was a very different, a completely, like, very shrill attitude. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. They're open about things like, well, the incredible range of restaurants. I want to try a different type of food every night of the week, that kind of thing. But they're certainly not open about ideas. They're very rigid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember I went to this anarchist book fair. I think it was in 2011. I was living in San Francisco. And I genuinely found it interesting. It was a huge thing. And it was full of libtards and worse, Antifa types, people like that. But there were things in it that were fascinating to me. There were a lot of publishers. There was one guy who was...
Just before you go into that anecdote, I want to put up this this photo that was shared the other day. Right? I mean, look at all the rules. This is all the stuff that you can't be if you want to be on the left. That is incredible.
Yes, that's hilarious. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, look how easy it would be to offend this person. Just any indiscretion, you know.
Respect existence or expect resistance. Yeah. Well, this is so hilarious. So it was there, and there were things that were fascinating. Like, there was a guy running a table who had a seed bank. Basically, he was collecting seeds of all kinds of rare varieties of plants. And I love that, because that's genuine biodiversity, right? That was beautiful. But there were other things there that, of course, were completely wacko. But the thing that amused me most was these people had, I think it was like Earth First or something like that, or one of these radical groups. They had all these posters up. No, posters are there to be looked at. And I took out my phone, and I wanted to take pictures of some of these posters. And this guy behind the table just went fucking, pardon my French, nuts. He was just unhinged. It's like, what are you doing? Why are you taking, it's like, why are you so paranoid? What's wrong? These things are there to be seen, right? But I just had that sense that these people are highly neurotic, extremely closed, extremely paranoid, extremely suspicious, extremely aggressive, right? That's the left. That's the left for the most part. The guy who was collecting and preserving for posterity rare seed varieties was an outlier in those circles, probably. And even he probably had crazed, intolerant ideas, but the stuff he was doing was just intrinsically interesting and good for the world. So yeah, the personality of the left, especially the far left, I think is extremely rigid, dogmatic, and opposed to openness. And I think a lot of the openness that they promote as a weapon against society. Did you hear recently about the massacre that took place in Haiti?
Yes.
Okay, there are people who are trying to import tens of thousands of these Haitians, people like that, to America. What percentage of those people believe that they will actually make America a better place? And what percentage of those people think that white Americans are horrible people and they deserve to have these savages inflicted on them for their sins. I think a very high percentage of dyed-in-the-wool leftists want to import savages like that to hurt society, not to make it better, to hurt society. You know, maybe they have a vision that, you know, if they completely destroy civilization, that somehow magically things will get better. I think that a lot of them wouldn't care about that. They'd probably say that, but you know, deep down in their hearts, they don't even care about that. They're just motivated by a lust for destruction, and they look upon these primitive people as just bioweapons. And I think a lot of this openness is just a weapon against the people that they hate,
and standards as well, social standards that they hate, because the very idea of hierarchy, you know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, Peter Hitchens said that when he was, I mean, it's a famous quote from him, that when he was a Trotskyite, it was not because he and his fellow Trotskyists were not motivated by love of England, but or love of ideas, but hatred of England. Mm-hmm. So it was a way for them to damage England, to damage Britain. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting admission.
Yeah, absolutely. I need to add that to my repertoire. That's useful.
All right. Well, I guess we should probably wrap up now.
Are there any super chats?
Oh, yes. I'll have a look at that. But in the meantime, is there anything else that you'd want to say about the incoming Trump administration? Because that does seem to be the main thing here.
No, I can't think of anything else. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be interesting. Like I said, I think there are going to be a lot of intellectual battles that happen. I think that we are positioned to win those battles, and that it will cause more people to rally to us if we can get the word out that, you know, we're taking part in this. So that's important. I do think that even though for some reason I'm on the enemies list at X, that certainly other people aren't, and that these ideas are going to circulate. So through that platform especially. So I'm very optimistic about that. Some of the things I'm looking forward to doing in the new year, VDare shut down this year. That was a big loss for the movement. They were shut down due to lawfare. Countercurrents is going to try and bring over some of the VDare writers who wrote on immigration. And Countercurrents, for the last few years that we looked while VDare was active, we had twice the traffic of VDare. So we have a big platform, and we hope that if immigration and deportation become big issues, let's just say emigration, let's put the emphasis on emigration, not immigration. Deportation, remigration, those are going to be big issues. I'm hoping that the VDare writers are going to be able to participate in those debates. If not on VDare, then at Countercurrents. If not at Countercurrents, maybe at Homeland Institute or other platforms. So that's one of the things that I definitely want to do in the new year. We're also putting together some IRL private events for readers, writers, donors, friends in the new year that I'm very excited about. And we're just going to keep doing more of the same, but better to a bigger audience. That's the way it's been every year with Countercurrents. Every year, our audience grows. Every year, we try and keep the quality high, bring in new people, do more. And also, because we have so many newcomers coming in, we want to give them access to the basics, right? We can't just assume that, well, all these things have been discussed to death. They have by us, but a lot of people are coming in who are new, and they need basics, white nationalism 101 classes, things like that. So we're providing that as well. So I'm very excited for the new year. I think that everybody should be of good cheer. That's what I always say at these millennial things. Be of good cheer, because we're on the upswing. There is a sense, I think, that the right is on its way up, and the left and the establishment are on their way down. That's what I'm betting on. And I think that now some of the rats on the other ship are betting on that too, or thinking that's where the things are going. And they're going to try and co-opt some of our ideas. Again, they're just trying to adjust themselves in the saddle, so to speak. Try and get a new grip on power to deal with changing circumstances. But ultimately, our goal is to replace them before they replace us. Replace the existing establishment before the establishment can replace us. And we're going to continue pushing that. There's no question about it. But I think things are going to get easier and easier in the new year. And it's not going to be a cakewalk. It's going to be a struggle, but it's going to be an enjoyable struggle because I think that we're on our way up and they're on their way down.
Well, I certainly hope that you're right. It would be great if things got easier for us. That would be just tremendous. Okay, there are quite a few super chats. If you have any questions for Greg, now would be the time to post them. But first I want to just read out, someone said earlier, when we were talking about the center-right, someone said, center-right just wants to grill. And it reminded me of this hilarious meme that I'll put up on screen now. It's one of my favorite memes of the normie.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I just love that. Right, Scott said, Merry Christmas, Greg and Woz. Merry Christmas, Scott. Greg, do you think Mark Andreessen is a Countercurrents reader? He has quoted Sam Francis and Carl Schmitt approvingly on Twitter. His recent tweet about effective altruism cuts to the heart of left liberalism. Mark Andreessen.
Yeah, I think it's totally possible. When I founded Countercurrents, I wanted this to attract people. I wanted to be a website for people with IQs 120 and above. And I wanted to attract people like that, because people like that are influential disproportionately. And a lot of people in Silicon Valley are like that way. And he's a Silicon Valley capitalist, major investment capitalist. And he clearly is dealing with some of our ideas. Just like J.D. Vance is. J.D. Vance is plugged in to the ideas that circulate through Countercurrents and from Countercurrents out into social media. I think Andreessen definitely, put it this way, if we sat down and had a conversation, we'd have a lot to talk about. I swear that there's reason to think that Elon Musk has read Countercurrents. There are certain things that he has said. Basically, okay, the main reason I think that he's read Countercurrents is because one of the nichest little articles that Rich Hauck wrote for Countercurrents that became viral, like his stuff always does, was his thing about why ice cream machines are always broken. And not terribly long after that was being shared widely on X, there was a tweet from Elon Musk about the ice cream machine being broken. I just thought, could it be coincidence or could it be something else? Our ideas circulate to people like that. Silicon Valley oligarchs read Countercurrents. I would certainly bet on that. Sadly, though, there's no evidence that Silicon Valley oligarchs are donating to Countercurrents. Because if they were, we'd have a whole lot more money. No, Silicon Valley oligarchs are donating to things like, is it IM-1776? Does anyone out there know what IM-1776 is?
I've heard of it.
Basically, it's a Countercurrents knockoff run by Jews. I mean, that's just reading it, that's what I infer from it. They have articles on topics like you would find at Countercurrents, but it's all subtly inflected by Jews, basically. It's a Jew-friendly, and I would therefore say Jewish-run and Jewish-founded and funded alt-right intellectual zine. I don't know what their traffic is, but I see these things pop up and I think it's flattering. It's flattering that people will invest hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe, in the startup of something like that, that is basically designed to impose itself between people out there in the world and Countercurrents. Yeah, to box us in, to screen us off, to box us in. And of course, that's true of a lot of these grifter types on the left. On the right, these grifter types on the right. We saw them with the so-called alt-light back in 2015. And there are whole generations that have been raised up since then that are performing the same function.
Yeah.
They do this because they know that intelligent people will read this kind of stuff and get hooked on it. So they're willing to invest some amounts of money in the hope that they'll get boxed in at something like this Jew-friendly sandbox site and not find their way to Countercurrents. I find that fascinating.
Yes. Yeah, there are equivalents of that that are... I could name, but I shan't. Okay, Green Party asks, is Dr. Johnson seeing an uptick in Countercurrents readers and subscribers?
Yes.
Yes, you said that earlier. That's good news. I'm glad. Post-American said, today I saw a clip from a Peter Thiel interview where he says, the real threat to social stability is not a communist or fascist uprising from alienated men in their 20s, but a gerontocracy of old people unwilling to make necessary changes. Do you agree with this analysis?
Yes, completely.
Yeah.
This is why life extension is a dangerous thing. Years ago, I came up with the idea of a dystopian novel I was going to call The Elders, and it would just be an exploration of what a horrible world it would be if, basically, you know, in terms that we would understand today, the boomers never die, right? What if we're ruled by people who are 400 or 500 years old?
And they're still singing Imagine.
Yeah, and we could never, and we just imagine how difficult it would be to relate to a human being that was born at the time of Elizabeth I. And yet these people would have all the power because they've been around all this time and they'd have all the advantages. It would be an extremely dysfunctional form of life. And this is why we really do need retirement ages, mandatory retirement ages for people in politics, for one thing. But even more so, even if they're retired, they still have a huge amount of power and influence as it is. And so it is a problem. As life expectancies rise, the tyranny of the old will become a greater and greater thing.
Yes, indeed. I mean, this is something I've talked about myself, that I see it as so bizarre and unnatural and unhealthy that American politics is dominated by people in their 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. I mean, good God. How can they possibly be in touch with society as it is today? Now, obviously, Donald Trump, well, the thing is, I think his heart is in the right place, but I actually don't think he is really in touch with the way society is.
No.
Now. I think he's tied to an America from the 80s. But whatever, the point still stands. What is Nancy Pelosi doing in politics? What is Joe Biden doing in politics? It's grotesque. But anyway, I'll move on to the next one. This is also from Post American. there is growing resentment among East Asian men about the degree to which Asian women date white men. This is seen in the Oxford study trend on TikTok, where they attack Asian women who post videos of their white boyfriends and husbands. Can we convince Asian men that racial separation would benefit them romantically?
Absolutely. I think they're already convinced. In a interracial dating market, the hugest losers are black women and Asian men.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Therefore, Asian men have a huge vested interest in barriers to miscegenation, basically, and interracial dating. I think it would be very easy to, if we have an Asian minority in our society still someday, as white nationalism becomes a thing, I think it would be very easy to get Asians on board, Asian males on board, with erecting barriers to race mixing, because they're the big losers in that. And white black women are the big losers too in that. They are the least attractive women in the interracial dating market, and Asian men are the least attractive men in the interracial dating market.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's sad for them, but of course it's all the more reason why it's actually a cruelty to mix the races together.
Yeah.
Because you end up with this terrible disparity that must just really burn. It must hurt them.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of Asian incels.
Yes. Well, I mean, look at, what was his name, Elliot Rogers. Mm-hmm. He was half Asian, and he clearly felt the yeah. Well, anyway, let's move on. So, Judy, yes, thank you. I'm not going to read that out, but thank you, Judaism. Now, Libertum, last year you talked about the most important people promoting white well-being. Who would you suggest this year?
Well, let me think. I can't remember who I said last year. There are definitely some people that I think are very important this year. One of them is coming on soon today is Angelo Plume. He's been doing a very good series called the New Nationalism Podcast, which is an attempt to do the basics, get back to the basics as a place that people can go if they're just exploring these ideas, they want to dip their toe in. I think that's a hugely important thing. I think Selner has made huge steps forward in this year. I'm very, very impressed with what he's been doing in Austria. So those are a couple of names that I think have come forward as important figures. So yeah, listen to Angelo later on. I think that's a good start. And follow Martin Selner's work on social media. He's doing tremendous things.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I agree. Matt says, thanks for streaming. Thank you. Darby says, I hope Trump has hardened his heart and is ready for battle. Saw this morning the federal government was selling massive pieces of unused border wall and marshals for as little as $5. That sounds quite strange. I don't really understand that. But yes, obviously we all hope that Trump is more aware now of what he's up against than he was in 2016, for sure. Open borders. Love Greg Johnson and Countercurrents. Also love his film reviews. Would be great to see more film reviews between Greg and Woz. Well, that's... I mean, obviously there's Decameron and there's the Last Things Film Festival as well. Film seems to be a big part of for a lot of people. It seems to be very relevant, cinema. A lot of people want more of that. And, I'll see what I can do next year. I'll see.
One project that I'm putting together for the new year, which is based on request from Italian and French publishers, is a Best of Trevor Lynch collection that they can translate. And so I've been trying to figure out what would go into that, because over the years I've published now 5 volumes of film reviews, and there's a 6th volume that's being collected together. I published more than 1,000 pages of this. So I'm trying to figure out what would go in a best of collection. So that'll be a project that will appear next year, probably.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. Hideaway Swamp. What does Greg think about what is going on in Syria? It's a very big topic for this point in the stream, but Greg, could you give us your Cook's Tour version of this?
I honestly don't know what's going on in Syria. I think that I'm more capable of commenting on what the collapse in Syria means for people around the world than I am to talk about what happened there, because frankly, the whole thing is baffling to me. Basically, I've never been a great believer that white nationalists in the West can get much from an alliance with Muslims. And I've known people who've been in this for decades and decades, people like Sam Dixon, who've explored this. This has been explored by previous generations. And the answer has always been, well, they just don't get it. They don't understand. They don't have their acts together. They're not, they're just not allies. And it's just a waste of money and waste of time. Oil sheikhs and people like Gaddafi never put anything into our cause, as far as I know. And just because these people are enemies of Israel, that's not a reason to sympathize with them. And so I just look at this and I pity the people who overinvested in the axis of resistance or the Muslim alliance against Zionism or whatever. Because the collapse of Assad, it's just so pathetic. But I don't even blame Assad so much. I just have to say that this is because of the low quality of human material in the Arab world. These people are just inferior to Europeans in dramatic ways. They might have small elites that are of superior quality, but the vast majority of these people are extremely backward, inbred, literally inbred, superstitious, cruel, cowardly, petty people who are not capable of functioning in a modern society. They're clannish people who sell out people for money or, you know, petty motives having to do with slights 3 generations back. And it's child's play for the Israelis or the Americans or any other group of people who want to toy with these people to get them fighting with one another, to pull the rug on their countries and make them collapse and things like that. And it's just sad. It's a lesson about biological and cultural diversity. And it's a lesson against third worldist hopes and dreams and memes in our community to see this happening. I also think this makes Russia look extremely bad, because Russia failed miserably in protecting its ally and client state, Armenia, a couple years ago. And they have failed even more miserably in propping up another client state, namely Syria today. And all of this traces to the fact that Russia has basically shot its wad, pardon my vulgar expressions, with this war in Ukraine, which I hope will come to an end when Trump takes office. I certainly pray that that'll happen because it's gone on long enough. But yeah, the serious thing is the kind of thing that race realists and historical realists and cultural realists such as us, people like us, should have expected and not have been so surprised by.
I mean, the enemy of your enemy is not necessarily your friend. I think that's a very important thing here. For the sake of the hate speech laws, I will disavow what Greg said about the quality of people there. I'm sure it's just down to the culture. and has absolutely nothing to do with the DNA or anything like that. And then finally, so Matt said, y'all and A. Walrus should get together for a stream. That's something to consider. I think I have been, I'm sure I've been in contact with him in the past. I'm sure he was on Millennial. But anyway, and then White Pill sends a smiley face. Thank you. And then Alabama Hot Pockets asks, who is that in your avatar, Greg? I've always wondered.
That is the a Renaissance engraving of the Roman god Janus, who is the god of the old and the new. And so it's a representation of basically a face looking back to the past and looking forward to the future. January, the first month of the year, takes its name from this Roman god. And I first used this on the cover of my book, Old Rite versus New Rite, because I was thinking of looking back at the old and forward to the new. So I love this image, though. I think it's a great avatar for not just that book, but sort of for what I've been doing. So yeah, that's the source of it. I don't even know the name of the artist, but it is an engraving from the Renaissance, and I don't know if it's an engraving based on an actual Roman original or not.
Okay. I think you did explain this once before on Millennial, but of course people wouldn't have watched every episode.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's end it there because the next stream is due imminently. Well, now, really. So, and that's with John Waters. But in the meantime, Greg, this has been a very good conversation. And thank you for maintaining your perfect record of appearing on Millennial.
My year. Perfect attendance record, yes. Yeah. Well, it's a real pleasure and a real honor to be here. I always enjoy this. And I love your audience. And Merry Christmas to you all and be of good cheer.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much, Greg. Everyone else, I will be back very soon.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.